Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's the Friday News Roundup, where we check in with area journalists for the news making regional headlines this week. The Cape Cod Commission has launched a new project called Cape Cod Outdoors to create an interactive map of recreational opportunities on the Cape. And we'll check in with a local food pantry as federal food aid, known as SNAP, is delayed amid the government shutdown. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with those stories. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, good to be here, Mindy.
All right, Cape Cod Outdoors is the working title for a new online tool that's still in development. So tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, so this is a project led by the Cape Cod Commission, and the idea is to create a user-friendly online recreation map of the whole Cape. But it is not really just a map. They're calling it a map-based application because it'll have a lot of functionality, lots of different ways that you can filter the map to show different things. At least that's the conception right now. It's going to be modeled after one from Western Massachusetts called Berkshire's Outside. And on that website, you can filter by different activities, you know, like swimming, hiking, whatever. And then also you can filter by a pretty long list of specific features or amenities, like can you bring a dog on leash or off leash? Are there restrooms? And various accessibility things as well. And one thing, an accessibility issue we've heard about on the Cape before is, can you get a wheelchair down to the waterfront? And that's one of the things that this filters for as well. So, you know, this map could have a lot of good information.
Yeah. And so getting the data for the map sounds like a big undertaking, and a lot of it will have to come from individual organizations that manage different properties. How are they going to do that?
Yes. Well, the Cape Cod Commission has two other groups working with them, the Chamber of Commerce, Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, and the Compact of Cape Cod Conservation Trusts. So they will have interns. They'll have a member of AmeriCorps as well, helping with collecting all of that information. This project has a state grant of about $60,000. I talked with Jessica Rempel from the Cape Cod Commission, and she said they know that it's going to be kind of like a living document, this map. You know, the information about these places, their details, their opening times and things do change all the time. But she says the map listings will be linked to the websites for the source organization. So, you know, people who actually own or operate those spots will have some input as well.
Sounds handy for sure. All right, let's talk about the situation with the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP. This is the program that used to be called food stamps. Benefits have been delayed for November. We're expected to be half the usual amount. I think a federal judge has said that now they need to give it all. But we're going to get a local angle. First, remind us how we got here.
Sure. It's been kind of like fast moving with a little something happening each day, actually. So the federal government shutdown is ongoing, and as a result of that, the Trump administration's Agriculture Department, the USDA, said before the new November 1st deadline that it was not going to be issuing the benefits for SNAP. Then two federal judges said stopping the benefits was illegal, that the administration would have to use emergency funds. The Trump administration said those funds would only cover half the benefit. And then yesterday, the latest thing that I've seen, a judge ordered the administration to pay the full amount somehow, regardless of that that complaint, that claim that the contingency funds would only cover half. So either way, though, it does seem like people's benefits are being delayed at a minimum.
Yeah. And you visited a food pantry on Cape Cod this week because pantries have been expecting to see increased need. What'd you find?
Yeah, I dropped by the sandwich food pantry to see how things were going there. There were eight people waiting outside, including an infant that a woman was holding. But that's not really unusual, actually, because only a small number of people are allowed in at once. So they weren't really overwhelmed. The volunteers were too busy to talk right then, because I had kind of dropped in at that one moment where, you know, they have a pretty short window when they give out food. But I was able to speak to the director later, and her name is Gigi Ridgely. She said that they had four new households sign up for the pantry last week. Sounds small, maybe, but for a one community pantry like theirs, it's way above normal. She said they normally have like one or two new families a month, so it is higher. They're also seeing more donations, though.
Yeah, I bet that's true of all the food pantries. So what kind of donations do they need most?
Well, they don't really have a wish list. She said non-perishable food is always welcome, as she put it, anything in a can or a box that people can eat. But generally, with the perishables, pantries like to control kind of the flow of that by using monetary donations to buy them themselves because they have to store it and all of that. But Gigi Ridgely said at Sandwich Food Pantry, at least, both food and money are welcome. She knows a lot of times people really do want to give food. But the thing with the cash donations is that the pantry can go up to Boston and buy things in bulk from the Boston Food Bank. So they do get more for their money that way than you would be able to get in the community.
There are many other food pantries in our region that might have their own requests, too, right?
Yes. So some pantries do have items they would like to get more of and items they might like to get less of. Gigi Ridgely at the Sandwich Food Pantry said one thing they do give out a lot of is toilet paper. So that's a good item. Everybody needs that.
Yeah.
But if folks go to the pantry story that's on our website right now, we have a link in that story to a big list from Barnstable County of pantries and meal sites across the Cape and on Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket.
We have one more story to go before you go. This is about the legal designation in Massachusetts known as the seasonal communities designation. Some towns on the Cape have it, some don't, but they want the opportunity to apply. So tell us more about this and what the purpose is.
Yeah, we know many of our communities are very seasonal in the sense that the population swells in the summer. They have heavy tourism. And one of the big consequences of that is that it pushes housing prices up. So this legal designation that was created last year for a seasonal community is supposed to give towns certain tools to deal with those housing costs and especially to help year-round residents and the year-round economy. So, for example, a town that has this can raise their local tax exemption on a primary residence to a higher level than would normally be allowed. And multiple other things. But the law gave some communities this designation automatically or said that they would have it if they had a certain threshold of seasonal housing. Other towns did not make that cut. They didn't have that percentage right away. So they could be allowed to have the seasonal designation based on some state regulations that have yet to be published. So one thing that happened this week is legislators from the Cape, bipartisan group of them, signed a letter to the Healey administration asking, first of all, for the rest of the Cape to definitely be eligible. Mm-hmm. And then they're asking for those rules to be issued by the end of the year.
So what did the legislators have to say in the letter?
Well, again, they want all of the Cape to be eligible. Those details of those regulations are still to come out. So they're hoping that the Cape will be eligible. They said the timing is actually pretty important. It's not a minor issue because in those new rules, they'll be creating some kind of a path that towns are going to have to approve at town meeting. And they're saying that they need the winter in order to write those town meeting articles for the spring.
And you talked with Senator Dylan Fernandez about this. What did he have to say?
He emphasized the timing also, but he pointed out that on the Cape, even though you could look at the list of towns and say, oh, well, you know, more than half the towns already have this, he says the major population centers on the Cape do not. Places like Barnstable, Yarmouth, Falmouth, they do not have it automatically. They have more year-round homes than some other places, but Fernandez says they're still very much affected by the economics of being a travel destination here on the Cape. So he does view that seasonal communities designation as something they should have the option to do.
Right. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Thank you, Jeanette.
All right, thanks.
All right, CAI's science and environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes joins us. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Mindy.
All right, you've been keeping tabs on local beach cleanups happening this fall, and you reported on a four-day effort along the National Seashore, despite the federal government shutdown. So what was that, a big hurdle?
Well, so that was the 10th annual Great Beach Cleanup organized by the Center for Coastal Studies. And I spoke to Laura Ludwig, who's in charge of CCS's Marine Debris and Plastics program. She said it was more of an administrative headache than a problem for the volunteer cleanup crew, which calls itself the Beach Brigade. She said there are still two senior rangers on duty, and she was able to coordinate with them, and she secured the necessary permit just before the shutdown, so that wasn't a problem. There were more issues on the backside of the cleanup, though. Last year, they removed over 2,000 pounds of plastic trash from the National Seashore during the Great Beach Cleanup, and because of that, They were told that this year they would have the help of the park's maintenance crew to haul away all that trash to be sorted and counted. But that crew has been furloughed, so they didn't have that help.
And you reported the Beach Brigade was working off Cape this week in Fairhaven. So what's going on there?
Yeah, this is the start of a two-year effort around Vineyard Sound and Buzzards Bay. This week, CCS volunteers joined a slate of local organizations for a cleanup on Marsh Island, which is actually a peninsula in New Bedford Harbor. And Marsh Island overlooks the New Bedford fishing piers from the other side of the harbor, and the goal is to turn that into a park.
What other areas will be included in this two-year project?
They're targeting marine debris on Martha's Vineyard, Cutty Hunk, and No Man's Land, in addition to Marsh Island. And this whole thing's funded through an Environmental Protection Agency grant, so federal tax dollars are paying for it. And that's what Ludwig says her biggest concern is, not just during the shutdown, but the drying up of federal funding in general to pay for this type of work.
And also, you spoke this week with a scientist from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution who's headed to Brazil, right, for COP30, the 30th United Nations Climate Change Conference. So what's HUI doing there?
Yeah, this is the fourth year that HUI scientists will be helping to run the Ocean Pavilion at COP. I spoke with senior scientist Ken Bissler. Brazil will be his third COP, and he says it's important to have people there to represent the interests of the ocean.
Yeah, tell us more about the Ocean Pavilion. This is a big deal. Yeah.
It is. So while high-level diplomatic talks are happening mostly behind closed doors, much of the action for COP observers happens at these pavilions. Most COP pavilions represent various countries participating in the conference. They host lectures and plan discussions, and basically they market their country. It's like a big trade show. So Bessler and others will be speaking about the importance of protecting the ocean and also how the ocean can help sequester carbon to be what he calls a climate hero. And again, they'll have this beautiful pavilion with pictures of marine life and just an attractive place to hang out.
Okay. What are the other organizations involved in the Ocean Pavilion?
So HUI and Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UCAL San Diego are taking the lead, but there are a total of 18 partners in the effort, and those include philanthropic and policy and engineering organizations in addition to ocean science outfits.
And this year, those organizations will be proposing an ocean declaration. Tell us about that.
That's right. It's a document that calls on nations to take concrete steps to safeguard the ocean and communities that depend on the ocean. And it includes a list of specific actions. Those are recognizing the ocean as a central climate regulator, ensuring ocean-based climate solutions are accessible, inclusive, and just, accelerating nature-based ocean and coastal solutions, developing new technologies to track chronic and episodic threats, establishing robust monitoring, reporting, and verification systems, catalyzing innovative finance mechanisms, and committing to funding ocean mapping, observing, and monitoring systems.
A lot going on there. All right, yeah. CAA Science and Environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyce. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
A federal judge agrees with the Trump administration they can reconsider the approval of South Coast Wind. Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times is here with more. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Benny.
All right, tell us more about this ruling.
Yeah, so you might say this is kind of a smaller battle within the larger war that the offshore wind under Trump. But there's a number of planned wind farms off the coast, some in development, some kind of near completion. But folks probably remember South Coast Wind was one of the larger ones, about 150 turbines. The Biden administration really passed this days before he left office, and then Trump came in, and kind of South Coast Wind was one of the first they targeted. But the town of Nantucket filed this lawsuit in March, basically saying the federal government for approving South Coast Wind wasn't considering the impacts to the island environmentally, historically, on their viewshed. And then a few months later, the Department of Justice joined in, basically claiming the same thing. And this week, a judge agreed, basically ruling that BOEM, that's the agency in charge of permitting offshore wind, they can reissue a decision on South Coast Wind and possibly reject it right out, maybe put some conditions on it, or just approve it again.
Yeah. So what's South Coast Wind say about all this?
Right. Well, it's kind of interesting. When Trump first came into office, They almost came out and told their investors, hey, we might be on hold for 4 years during the administration. But they also have said, you know, they've invested a lot in this project, something like $600 million since 2018. And they're ready to get going. So we'll see. I don't, you know, it could be after the Trump administration, they could be on hold until then, but really up in the air to see where this goes.
Yeah. So not over yet. Yeah. Right. All right. In other news, funding for the renovation and addition at the regional high school will go to an island-wide vote rather than town by town. Is this unusual?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think most so the high school project, a huge project, we've been reporting probably the biggest publicly funded project on the Vineyard, something like $330 million. And right, traditionally, I think towns were under the impression that this would go to a kind of town meeting by town meeting. But the school committee, and you know, this is all above board. This is in the law. They could say we'd like to do this as a regional island-wide vote. And kind of the rub is, you know, everyone's going to be voting one way or the other. But when you have a town by town, if one town says we don't like this project, it could sink the whole project, and the towns and the project would lose out on about 30% funding from the state. And there's a history on the island for people rejecting school votes, projects, as happened in Tisbury. So school officials are kind of saying this gives us a little more control, maybe, that if the island as a majority wants this, then they should get the vote on it that way. Whereas if you have, you know, a super majority and then one town says we don't want this project, it could ruin it for everybody. Yeah. So,
and does it seem like I don't even know if you know the answer to this, island-wide people are, because it's in rough shape, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like something has to be done. So does it seem like most are in favor of this? Because it's expensive.
Yeah, it's really hard to tell. I couldn't say one with the other. But
what's the like $340 million or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, and this is an early estimate, so we don't know officially yet. But it's $334 million, I think, is the price tag, and the state is offered about a 30% reimbursement. Mm-hmm. So my sense, you know, school officials are saying we really need this to happen. If we don't do this now, the state might not reimburse us, and we're going to have to do the project anyway. So we got to get this done.
More to come, as they say.
Exactly.
All right. Tell the girls' soccer team in the playoffs.
Yeah, this is probably my favorite story of the week. But the girls' soccer team has been great to cover this year. They've lost one league game, I believe. They've had 5 shutouts. Just an awesome team. And this week, they in the kind of early rounds of the playoffs, they're going to the quarterfinals this weekend. But they had this game. It was 0-0 all game. Went to 2 sudden death overtimes. Still no one scored. And then they go to a shootout where there were 24 rounds of shootouts.
Wow.
Yeah, which is amazing. We actually called the state that's running the tournament. They said it's the highest they've ever seen on their records. And the kind of the fun part is the Vineyard won kind of a dramatic fashion. and they're playing on Saturday. So we'll see that if they win then they'll go to the semifinals. So
pretty exciting. All right. Yeah. Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Coming up, voters on Nantucket approve unrestricted short-term rentals. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. Nantucket voters approved unrestricted short-term rentals at a special town meeting this week. Josh Balling from the Inquirer and Mirror has the details. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
This issue has been hotly debated, right, for years.
It has. It took years of debate, but only about 45 minutes of discussion on Tuesday night to finally come to a decision after 5 or 6 town meetings. I can't even remember anymore how many times this has been brought up in various ways, shapes, and forms in different proposals. But voters on Tuesday night took just under an hour to vote decisively in favor of allowing short-term vacation rentals without restriction and pretty much resolving a lot of legal uncertainty that has loomed over the practice, and at least for now, bringing some closure to a really controversial issue that has been dividing neighborhoods and islanders for almost a half a decade. The vote was strong. 10-45 in favor, 4-21 opposed. About 71% voted in favor of the article from island fishing captain Brian Borgeson to classify short-term rentals as a principal use in the town zoning code. Presently, or prior to this approval and then pending the Attorney General's approval, for some reason, Nantucket Zoning Code did not reference rentals of any kind, short-term or long-term. Mm-hmm. It was taken out at some point inadvertently during some cleanup of the zoning code in a past year. And that led to a lot of legal challenges and a land court judge earlier this year ruling that he would have to say that short-term rentals are not allowed in residential zones on Nantucket because the zoning code made no reference to the two of them. Mm-hmm. So this changes that. It allows short-term rentals as a principal use in all residential zones on the island.
And that doesn't preclude any zoning changes down the line, right? This is
Zoning changes down the line, although that would require a two-thirds majority, which was the big hurdle in getting any short-term rental zoning article approved until Tuesday. Potentially, probably more likely, it also doesn't preclude some type of regulation or guardrails being voted on as part of the town's general bylaw, which only requires a simple majority to pass. As of Wednesday, there hadn't been any discussion or any real certainty yet whether that would happen at the next town meeting coming up in the spring. The smart money says that there'll probably be a couple of proposals in the spring that might bring a little bit of regulation potentially to short-term rentals.
Yeah, but this was a large turnout, right? I mean, there was a lot of people who turned out for this meeting.
One of the largest that I can remember in the 30 or so years that I've been here. I think that we did a little research, and one past town meeting had about 1,600 voters, and there was about 15 and change at this one. There are more people and more registered voters on the island now, though, too. So the percentage wasn't necessarily anywhere near the highest that it's been in the past. But again, that they packed the high school auditorium, the high school gym, and there was a little bit of overflow in the middle school gym for all the voters that showed up.
Yeah. Right, and as we know, Hurricane Melissa was devastating to Jamaica, and Nantucket's Jamaican community has been sitting on pins and needles waiting word of their loved ones. And you had a story about that this week.
We did. It was really a heart-wrenching story. Our staff collaborated. All of them pitched in and did an incredible job to reach out to our Jamaican community. We have a sizable Jamaican community on the island, one of the sort of longest-standing immigrant communities on Nantucket. And they have been, fortunately, thankfully, now, about a week or more later, most of them have heard word of their families. Everyone we talked to, their families were okay. But for at least a week, with communications down and power out, they had no way to know what was going on in their home communities, how their families were doing, whether they had property there, how that had fared. And they're finally starting to get word, and there's obviously, widespread devastation to properties and buildings. They're really, the community here is coming together, but the Jamaican community and the overall community, there's a number of fundraisers scheduled. There's donation boxes at a number of island businesses. A couple of the members of the churches and the faith community are stepping up to provide comfort and support. And the island's really coming together, but obviously the entire country of Jamaica is going to take a lot to rebuild. And we're feeling it here on Nantucket as well.
Yeah, thank you. Josh Bolling from the Inquirer Mirror. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
A downtown park in Chatham will get a major makeover. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle has more on that. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
So is this a total remake for Kate Gould Park?
Well, it looks like that's ultimately going to be the goal here. They're really in a preliminary stage right now. And the impetus for this is that the front section of the park near the Main Street entrance, which is the site where, every year they do the Art in the Park exhibit and a few other events. And that area has really taken sort of a beating in the last several years. They can't grow grass there because of the foot traffic and everything. So they've been looking at options to try to spruce up that section of the park. And there's the Chamber of Commerce has a beautification committee that's sort of spearheaded this. And they took on sort of looking at the entire park. What they're basically proposing is to try to put some sort of pavers in the front section there where the grass just doesn't grow. And they've also had a study of the trees and other vegetation in the park, and several of the trees need to be removed because they're diseased or they're just old and compromised and constitute a sort of a safety hazard. Yeah. But what they decided to do is they put out these sort of very preliminary plans, and over the next several months they're going to be holding workshops and doing surveys to try to gauge how the public feels about some of these changes. And they started last week with the Board of Selectmen, or the Select Board, and there was a little bit of skepticism about doing any sort of paving in the park, but they're working with a landscaper who is sort of recommending that as to create sort of what they call the town square atmosphere in that part of the park. But I think people can be reassured that there won't be any major changes to, the areas further back in the park where the Chatham Band performs at the bandstand. None of that is going to change. Basically, it's a sprucing up of the park to sort of honor the legacy of Kate Gould, who was the woman who donated the land for the park back in the 1930s.
Yeah, and I guess she donated it wanting a space for peace and tranquility. So tell us a little bit about more who Kate Gould was.
So Kate Gould was a librarian at the Eldridge Public Library. And when she passed away, she entrusted that land to three local residents, trustees. And it actually was held in trust by the library for a number of years. Kate Gould, by all accounts, was a prominent local citizen. Running the library for many years, and she really had the idea of making this park as a memorial to her. Her stepfather and her mother. And if you go to the park now, there's a big boulder in the middle of it with a plaque on it dedicated to them. So that will remain. And her idea was that this would be a sanctuary in the middle of downtown Chatham. And many people have referred to this as sort of Chatham's Central Park. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it's going to stay. Her will dictated that no business be conducted in the park and no motor vehicles be allowed in the park. And none of that is going to change.
Yeah. Right. Another story you had this week, Cape Cod Regional Tech altering their plans for some needed new class space.
Yeah, the Cape Tech is planning a new veterinary science and environmental science program, and they had worked with the town to use some property on Main Street in North Chatham, North Harwich, a 33-acre conservation site where they're planning to use this as sort of a demonstration outdoor classroom, and they had hoped to build a building there to house classes. But at this point, they're backing off on that because of basically the cost, which had risen to about $10 million to build the modular classrooms that they were proposing. And they're working on reducing those costs. And instead of building the new classrooms at the conservation site, they're shifting that to build them at the Cape Cod Tech campus in Pleasant Lake. And that'll cut down quite a bit on the cost because obviously they won't need some infrastructure that the school already has in place, like parking and utilities, things like that. Mm. So they're looking at $5 to $7 million instead. And they're still in the process of trying to identify that money and apply for grants and raise the funds. And, they expect that to happen, but it may set the project back, a year or more in order to accomplish that.
Yeah. We talked a little bit earlier about the sandwich food pantry. You also have a story about the growing need for food pantries and what they're bracing for. Tell us a little bit about what you've reported this week.
Sure. We spoke to the Lower Cape Outreach Council, which runs small food pantries in each of the Lower Cape towns. And also with we spoke with the Family Pantry, which is obviously a more regional pantry. Both of them said that even before this sort of onset of the SNAP crisis, they'd seen a big increase in demand. And at the Family Pantry, they said last Thursday they had their largest ever day of folks coming in. They had 324 people come in a single day, which is at least mm-hmm. 50 or more people than they would usually get. And they're looking, they're expecting that to just continue as they ramp up and to take care of the folks who are needing help at this particular point in time. And they're looking at increasing their donations. They're hoping to get more help from not only the local community, but the Greater Boston Food Bank, where both these pantries get a lot of their resources from. And they're just sort of really girding for an onslaught of demand. in the coming weeks if the government shutdown doesn't end.
Yeah, it's really tough for the food pantries too, because you know, even though we're seeing donations of food rising, even when they go to the Greater Food Bank in Boston, they you know, still have to pay for things. And as we heard earlier from the sandwich pantry, you know, something that was used to be $2 is now, you know, $4 or $5. So so donations of money is also very helpful for these pantries.
That's definitely true. You know, the pantries feel the inflation in grocery prices just as much as the rest of us do.
Yeah.
And, you know, for people who are interested in contributing or either financially or otherwise, we have in this week's paper and on our website, we have resources where they can find out how to do that.
Great. All right. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Mindy.
When will funding for federal food assistance reach Massachusetts households? Will federal immigration agents be allowed to keep wearing masks while operating in Massachusetts? And what do new state regulations for senior home health care mean for the industry and its clients? CAI's Gilda Geis spoke with State House reporter Katie Lannon to get some answers.
Katie, it feels like the situation with SNAP funding changes every day, if not multiple times per day. So what's the latest?
Yeah, things have been really in flux for a while in the wake of the court ruling that said the government must pay out some SNAP benefits. We've seen the amount that's going to be paid out change. We still don't necessarily know the timing. Those state officials in Massachusetts are saying people can receive their benefits as soon as next week. And just today, now Attorney General for Massachusetts Andrea Campbell filed a request with the federal court and many of her counterparts along with her, asking that the court compel the Trump administration to deliver full SNAP benefits, saying that it's not acceptable for them to do what she's calling the bare minimum and in a way that's complicated and confusing and delaying benefits further. Governor Maura Healey has also said this week that she thinks the USDA, the agency that oversees the food assistance program, is putting out intentionally confusing guidance to make things harder here.
How are families who typically rely on government food assistance faring?
They describe it as being locked in kind of a waiting game, waiting to see what they'll be able to buy for groceries, when it will come. It's a scary situation, folks have said, not knowing and still being kind of on hold here. You know, if they're not able to do their regular grocery shopping, used to getting the benefits at the start of the month, many are left to turn to food pantries or other community organizations that have been saying that they'll do whatever they can to help and are buoyed by donations coming in, but can't really fill the full void of what the federal government could provide.
Also this week, Attorney General Andrea Campbell weighed in on a proposal to prevent federal immigration agents from wearing masks during immigration raids here in Massachusetts. What did she have to say about it?
Yeah, this is a bill that's been kicking around Beacon Hill, but hasn't gone very far in the process so far. The AG is saying that really this would be better regulated by the federal government. The state's authority to do such a thing is more limited. So she's saying that it's really the U.S. attorney who should be holding immigration enforcement agents and authorities accountable. That actually prompted the U.S. attorney from Massachusetts, Leah Foley, to respond with a pretty strongly worded statement of her own, saying that some of AG Campbell's comments about immigration enforcement were further stoking fear.
And finally, the State House passed a bill this week that would increase regulations for senior home health care. What are those regulations about?
Yeah, this is really about making sure that as the population in Massachusetts continues to age rapidly, what's being called the silver tsunami, that they know what they're getting as they seek home care services. So this would set up a licensing process for the home care agencies that offer assistance with non-medical tasks like eating, going to the bathroom, daily living activities. It also takes some steps that are aimed at protecting home care workers from abuse from their clients. So there's a few pieces going on there.
Katie Lannon from the State House, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, concerns from the Jamaican community on the Outer Cape after Hurricane Melissa, and is Trader Joe's coming to Mashpee? Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. We talked earlier about the Jamaican community on Nantucket and their concern about family and friends after Hurricane Melissa. Jack Steller from the Provincetown Independent tells us about the Jamaican community on the Outer Cape who also witnessed that devastation from afar. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Mindy.
So, Jack, you can only imagine how difficult it was for those with family and friends that you haven't been able to contact and all the news seeing all this horrible devastation.
Yeah, absolutely. This was an extremely devastating storm that hit communities that many people, Jamaican people living on the Outer Cape, are from. It took days for them to get back in contact with their families. And when they were able to get in contact with people back home, more times than not, they seemed to say that everything was gone, mm-hmm. including houses, churches, hospitals. And in some cases, people feared that family members or people they knew have died as well.
Yeah. You talked to one man who was flying back to Jamaica this week, not knowing what to expect when he steps off that plane.
Yeah, absolutely. I spoke to a man named Orlando Messina, who had been working as a seasonal employee at JD's Woodfire Grill here in Provincetown. And he went back on Tuesday, and yes, he told me he really had no idea what to expect. And I've actually been in contact with him over the last few days. And he told me that he has arrived in Jamaica and that he is safe, but that things are really bad.
And there's, of course, a lot of fundraising efforts on the Outer Cape to help us support some of these folks.
Yeah, there is. Of course, the Jamaican population makes up a major part of the workforce on the Outer Cape, and there have been multiple efforts to raise money and to bring in donations from local businesses like the Provincetown Stop and Shop, the Brick House Restaurant in Eastham, the Gifford House in Provincetown, the Lobster Pot, Max Seafood, and they are, you know, having a rallying around the Jamaican community. Unfortunately, even with all the money that is being raised, the devastation is so extreme that it does seem like there will need to be years of rebuilding.
Yeah, it's going to take a long time. Jack Steller from the Provincetown Independent. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
Seems a rumor about a popular grocery store just might be true. Callie Remillard from the Enterprise Newspapers is here. Hi, Callie.
Hi.
All right. Is Trader Joe's really coming to Mashpee?
It is true. It has been confirmed officially. We know for sure it is going to be a Trader Joe's.
And so it's not a totally done deal yet, right?
No, the development is not a done deal. They just held the first public hearing with the Mashpee Planning Board this week on Wednesday, the first of a series of public hearings. But it was the first time that we got official confirmation from the developer that we have signed a deal with Trader Joe's, and that is the specialty grocery store you've all been hearing about.
So you've been hearing about the specialty grocery store, and where exactly are they talking about putting it?
It's proposed for 647 Falmouth Road, which is just before the Mashpee Rotary in the Shellback Way development.
And I guess there's some maybe concerns about traffic there. That's a pretty...
Yeah,
area.
It's a really hot spot for development right now in Mashpee. You've got a Chipotle going in the area. You've got two housing developments in the area and this extremely popular grocery store. So really what it comes down to with all of the concerns about this are traffic.
Mm-hmm. So who's I'm sure there's always opposition, right? Who's the opposition to this?
So actually, the opposition to this is mainly abutters. And that is something that town planner Brian Tobin really directly addressed to the planning board. You know, he told them, you need to really consider all aspects of this application. A lot of the support we've heard is from people who really want Trader Joe's. They like the store. But all of the opposition we're hearing are from abutters, and they're concerned about traffic in their neighborhood.
And even the abutters, they like Trader Joe's, too. But they just don't like this location.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
No one is mad about the Trader Joe's, but they are mad about the location, and they're not sure this is the right location for this.
Is there a possibility of other locations? Have the developer talked about that at all, or is they're really set on this particular spot?
They haven't really talked about whether they're looking at other locations. I do know that the property is owned by the developer, so I'm sure that's why they thought it would be a great asset. Especially, you know, being near Mashpee Commons, not a bad location, but just the traffic it'll bring will be a mess.
Yeah. So how they have to figure out where the parking lot's going to be, what the entrance is going to be.
And they've already got a good plan. You know, it'll be like your typical Trader Joe's setup. The parking lot's kind of a one way in, one way out type of thing. And they've done a lot of, you know, thinking about how to set this up. But just will it come to fruition in the way that they've planned with their traffic study? Who's to say? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people in town are actually getting behind the idea that the town should do its own independent traffic study separate from that of the developer's traffic study. So
if this all goes through, when would they think this would be open? I love Trader Joe's. I'm ready to shop now.
I know. Me too. I don't know. I don't know when they're planning on having this developed. I do know that they are having the second public hearing will be on December 17th. That's a Wednesday. And then they're actually planning on scheduling a separate hearing that'll be wholly dedicated to traffic concerns. The developer is going to present the traffic study that they have done at that hearing, and then residents can ask questions and all that stuff. A date has not been set for that hearing yet, though.
So they don't have a date that they'd want to break ground yet that we know of?
Not that we know of, no.
All right, so we've got a couple more public hearings, and I'm sure you'll keep us updated.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Callie Remillard with the Enterprise Newspapers, as always. Thanks, Callie.
Thank you.
As the federal government works to erase historic markers from national parks and other monuments, some Boston organizers are leaning in to tell new stories about the state's anti-slavery past. Roseanne Warren has more.
It's not uncommon to walk through downtown Boston at any given time and see a walking tour of the city's historic past. They often follow Boston's revolutionary efforts. But a new tour from a group of community historians pays homage to those who fought against slavery.
The impact that the community of Black abolitionists and their allies had on the country itself, you know, and that it started here, right where we're standing.
That's Crystal Rawlins Jackson, president of Beacon Hill Scholars, the organization behind the project. The project is a self-guided tour called Abolition Acre. It follows 10 stops through the heart of downtown Boston and takes about 45 minutes to complete.
You're as close as you can be without actually being at the time with that person by walking in their steps and learning about what they did.
Rawlins Jackson's roots have been planted in Boston for generations. She discovered that one of her ancestors was active in this abolitionist movement.
I have been very dedicated to telling this story, and I will not stop. And hopefully, I hope that my ancestors are happy and pleased about that.
One particular story that the tour tells is that of Anthony Burns, a man who escaped slavery, made it to Boston, and was sent back to Virginia. Abolitionists attempted to rescue Burns, but President Franklin Pierce sent the military to Boston, and Burns was sent back to Virginia. The situation became a rallying cry for the anti-slavery movement in Boston, a story very similar to the ICE deportations and National Guard deployments currently happening, Rawlins Jackson says.
When you see what's happening now, you can understand where it came from.
Boston's abolitionist history tells a conflicting story. It was both the center for anti-slavery activism and a hub of the slave economy in the North. Kenasorn Wangshri Chanalai is the research director with the Massachusetts Historical Society. He says that exploring that tension fully and honestly will help us today understand more about our history.
The idea of this trail, the idea of pointing out places where people can go and imagine a world that was filled with promise as well as peril, is really exciting. It's a great opportunity.
Peter Snowd is a project coordinator with Beacon Hill Scholars and also very involved in the creation of this self-guided tour. He says the dedication of abolitionists at the time, fighting for the freedom of all in America, should serve as an inspiration while the freedoms of many are being challenged today.
And we're in a moment now where our democracy and our freedoms are at risk. And we should remember what they did and be inspired by them. And I think many of us are.
Snowd says he hopes visitors will see Abolition Acre as more than just a walk through old sites, but also as a way to forge the path ahead.
Unless you know about the story of slavery and genocide against indigenous peoples, and you know the resistance to that, you're not going to have a full picture of what this country is and could be.
And the Abolition Acre Trail hopes to guide people through that full picture, one step at a time.
That's Trajan Waring reporting. It's a time-honored tradition in northern Maine dating back to the 1940s. Every fall, schools in Aroostook County allow students to take 3 weeks off to help harvest potatoes. Michael Livingston reports the students learn life lessons they can't get in the classroom.
You can smell starch in the air as tractors kick up dirt and semi-trucks filled with potatoes can be seen rolling through towns. It's the first week of harvest, and farmers are racing to gather their crop before the frost. At Porter Farms in Presque Isle, 17-year-old Maddie Putnam grabs oozy, rotten potatoes as they tumble down a conveyor belt.
Well, the rotten ones are definitely, they have, you can like tell just by looking at them, they have like this like white gooey stuff, and there's definitely a smell that comes with it.
The smell to me is almost like a little bit of like bad breath is the best way I can describe it.
Carter Vigue's job is to pick out the rocks.
You can hear them hit on the metal parts of the line, so that'll give you an indicator for when to find those. It's definitely, it gets drilled right into your head. Like sometimes you'll have a dream about it almost, but.
The students' days are long. Work begins as early as 5:30 a.m. and can go past 8 hours, which is legally allowed when not in school. And once they clock out, many will go straight to evening sports practice. But Putnam says she'd rather be here than in the classroom.
I mean, out here I get paid.
At Porter Farms, the students make about $19 an hour.
I've been saving it for the past 4 years that I've been working harvest. Most of it has gone to my car. You know, definitely senior year going into college and stuff like that, I want to be able to have like a good foundational savings in my back pocket.
Farm owner Matt Porter says it's rewarding to be able to give high school students a job.
Maybe love it, maybe hate it, but get to understand how hard work earns a big paycheck. And it's just it's a great lesson in life of what we all get to do once we get out of high school.
Some school boards have canceled or scaled back their harvest breaks, in part because of lost classroom time. To make it up, they're required to start the school year earlier. Ben Greenlaw is the superintendent at Maine School Administrative District 1, which includes the towns of Presque Isle, Mapleton, Chapman, Castle Hill, and Westfield. He says last year, about 75 high school students took part in the harvest.
If you asked 100 people in the community, I think you'd get it pretty close to right down the middle for the people that would like to see it continue and for the people that would like to see us modified in some way, shape, or form.
About 7 years ago, his school board voted to eliminate the harvest break, but walked back on its decision after outcry from farmers. Potatoes, after all, are the state's top agricultural product. And in Aroostook County, where 90% of them are grown, potatoes are a way of life. Dozens of Aroostook County growers still hire students for harvest break, even though mechanized farming has made them less essential than they once were.
I can remember 12, 13 years old, and somebody wouldn't show up or somebody was sick, and they would come down to the potato house and grab me, and I'd be out there on the harvester.
Sixth-generation farmer Robbie Irving says it used to take a team of people to operate a harvester, a large machine that digs up potatoes and loads them on trucks. But new automatic harvesters can process twice the amount in faster time.
We're putting in just volumes of potatoes that we couldn't even begin to put in, you know, 10 years ago.
Irving says even though he hires fewer students, the lessons they learn on the job are the reasons to keep the tradition alive.
It's a labor of love, and it's really something that a lot of kids, you know, once they work a harvest, they obviously have a greater appreciation for the work that we do, but they also have a greater appreciation of what it means to so many people. Like, you're literally feeding America.
At one of his storage barns, Irving watches as his 15-year-old son Carter uses a forklift to move debris and then jumps into a tractor at least three times his height.
Well, I mean, it's like driving a truck, except a little harder, and you don't need a license. I mean, you just got to get taught how to do everything. I mean, around here, you just have to get taught how to do anything, and my dad is the perfect person to do that for you. And, yeah, I don't hate a thing. I love all of it.
For some kids, harvest break is a way to earn some extra money and develop a strong work ethic. For others, like Carter Irving, it's an education in taking over the family business, something they aren't likely to learn in school.
For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Michael Livingston.
And that's the News Roundup for this week. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.